Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101, Section 1 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 14, delivered on March 20, 2012. The title of this lecture is Industry Structures and Organization.
Today, Industry Structures and Organization. Now, this is somewhat of a repeat of what I had done before the break, but I want to make sure we're all back in the same mode, knowing the same things. Now, these are idealized to a certain extent. We break the different kinds of industries into four basic categories, depending upon the level of competition. The ideal sort of Adam Smith type of world, the world that is somewhat the way that more conservative economists see things, if you will, is this world of perfect competition, where you have these atomistic companies. In other words, they're so tiny that no given company or group of companies can really affect the amount that's being produced by the industry. None of them see the global demand. They don't see hardly a pinch of it. Atomistic competitors, they are all price takers. They can't fix a price. They more or less, although they could probably, in some cases, move their price a little bit up and down, people would just go and find somewhere else to buy the product if they go too far. And in some markets, like in grain markets, the farmer doesn't have any control, command over the price. He'll take whatever the market is offering him at the time he takes it to the buyers. Now, also in perfect competition, there is relatively easy entry and exit. There are no major barriers that keep companies from making a play in. If there's big profit being made, companies are just going to flow in. And if there are massive losses, companies are going to just get out of it. That's not always, of course, the case. There could be prohibitive costs of entry, and that's one of the ways that perfect competition falls apart, is if it's really, really expensive. Like, you can't make an auto company. You couldn't start an industrial manufacturing company. The costs are just ridiculous. And exits can be a very expensive proposition, too. In fact, in some states, it's... A good example of that is in some states with insurance companies, they're not allowed to leave the state. Even if they're taking massive losses, they can't just say, the hell with this state, we're going to stop writing insurance in this state. There are states that would prohibit them from doing that. So that idea of easy exit isn't always as in play. Now, information is readily available. It's not hard to find out what the price is that's being charged, what the more or less best practices are. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't differences in individual companies and how they're doing things. But if they're really doing something efficiently, it won't take long for the competitors to figure out, okay, this is a good technology, we're going to shift our production to this way of doing things. And as I had mentioned before, we see this all through history. Technological advances, technological change seems to diffuse very rapidly, long before there was anything like the internet, even in times that we would consider like the Bronze Age. Techniques for manufacturing metal, swords, shields, buildings, those seem to move pretty quickly away from where they had been developed, to the point where we can't, in some cases, tell where they started. So this idea of information availability is not a bad assumption. It takes a lot to hide a technological method, to protect your technology. Again, though, that doesn't mean that you won't see differences in cost curves among companies in perfect competition. You will, but it just means that over a period of time, anything that's like a best practice is probably going to show up pretty quickly. Price information, you can walk outside, you've got so many competitors, you can see what the prevailing price is and all of that. So that's perfect competition, and there are other assumptions I can throw in there too, but those are the big ones. In this kind of a case, what's going to happen, and you'll see me draw this over and over again, there is an enormous global market for the product. The supply curve is more or less just marginal cost curves above shutdown of the many, many companies. You aggregate them together, and I'll show you that in the next lecture. But the global demand is going down. Now, no company sees the global demand. You just don't. It's just ludicrously too large for you. Now, I've known many business people who read national journals, international business trade journals, and all that. And to some extent, that's kind of like, well, that's nice. It's a hobby, but you don't see global demand. You don't even see a tiny portion of it. You're in this tiny little place. You don't see these forces. You're just tiny compared to the global market. But that global market does exist. It is creating the equilibrium price and the equilibrium output of the industry at any given time. Now, that equilibrium price just imposes itself on the competing companies. Now, again, in given markets, there might be a larger or a higher or a lower price, but within a prevailing market, essentially this demand curve that the company faces is nothing but a perfectly elastic price curve. That equilibrium price imposes itself. The company could sell as much as it wants at that prevailing price. There's that much demand compared to the company. It won't. It'll maximize its profit. It won't sell more. It will not produce a unit that costs more than the price that it can charge, but it could sell as much as it wants because it's so tiny compared to the global demand. So in this case, that's why we say that the company is a price taker. It's not a price setter at all. It just takes the prevailing price. You can't, there are great examples of this where companies thought that they had a brilliant idea. They didn't have to be price takers. Now, at the retail level of gasoline, that's actually a quite competitive market, at least in small areas. You look around and you'll say, well, the price is about the same at all the different gas stations. They must be colluding. No, they're just in competition. They can't charge more than us. Well, they can try to bump it a little bit. But if they try to bump it too much, well, we're so special we can charge a higher price. They pay dearly for that. Great example of that was some years ago, there was a gasoline retail company, and there are still some stations around called Clark, but it was more prominent in an earlier time. And they had this genius idea that they were going to do a marketing campaign in which they were going to convince consumers that their gasoline was so much better that they could charge a quarter more for it. And they did this, I mean, in the time, this was one of those grandiose kinds of commercials that were in the 60s. They had a band playing, some guy saying, I know what you're thinking. This price is too high, but you're wrong, my friends, and here's why. Clark is unique, and I say unique, and I'll bet little green apples you'll agree. We sell just premium gasoline, and it's the best in the world. Well, apparently the consumers didn't think so. Clark got its ass kicked trying to do that. So that's an example of what happens when you think you're so special that you can jack your price up way high. Now, companies do try. You'll see these like BP, a few pennies higher maybe than, oh, we've got detergent in our gasoline. I'll pour some oil in my car. But they'll say, or we have this special formula that makes your engine have sexual desires and all this kind of stuff. I don't know. it really, they know darn well that they can't push it too far. Maybe a few pennies more a gallon. But realistically, you do see price discipline fairly strongly in these markets. And, well, interestingly enough, this price discipline is a good thing for consumers, because you'll see companies constantly trying to undercut each other, and of course they'll go out of business doing it. I think it was last week, there was this one of those pizza delivery cars. The car was actually kind of scary. It looked like it was going to fall apart or explode on the road. Some poor hoe-handle driver was driving a delivery. There was a sign on top of the car that said $7 for a large pizza. Now, probably that pizza sucks really bad, but you see that drive down in price. Well, if you're going to charge much more than that, you darn well better have a good reason and be able to market that good reason to your consumers, because otherwise, if I need a pizza and I see a $7 pizza, I'll buy it. And if it sucks, well, you know, I'll have diarrhea for a while. But see, that's that discipline, price pushing downward. And I'll talk about this just in next week. This idea of the power of perfect competition to hold prices down and competitors cutting each other's throats is considered highly desirable, and it's been a part of public policy since the late 1800s. And unfortunately, it's kind of fallen apart in your lifetimes, especially in your more adult years. A lot of this idea of fostering competition and breaking the backs of uncompetitive industries has really come apart under a string of presidents going well back, even into the 1970s, definitely into the 1980s, both Democrat and Republican, sort of have given up on this whole idea of fostering fierce competition and breaking the backs of these companies that are more concentrated in their industries. On the opposite end of perfect competition is the monopoly. That is where there is a single firm. Now, that's the idealized version. Realistically, you won't see a single firm in an industry. What you will see is a level of market concentration where one firm essentially dominates and can lead price and effectively break the backs of any competitor that gets in its way too far. That's the reality of it. Monopoly, in its idealized sense, doesn't have to be there for the effects of monopoly to exist. And you'll see that there are some really undesirable effects of these highly concentrated industries that have monopolistic characteristics. Really undesirable effects. But in its idealized state, a monopoly would be one firm. It would be a price setter because it is the whole market. Essentially, it faces the entire market demand curve. It is the industry. So it faces the entire global demand, or a huge piece of it. That would be the case of a Microsoft or a Google or perhaps some of the very, very large, well, oil companies. I'll get to another example there. But in a highly concentrated, monopolized industry, the global demand curve is faced by that company. It might not have all of that demand, but it sure sees it. It has to know what's going on all over the world. This was I take them from the university, the finance students, up to Chicago, where you run into these companies, and these guys are just sitting there talking to my students about how great the jobs are, and, you know, you put your application in here, and, you know, you may wind up in working in Switzerland, or in Bangkok, or in Jakarta, or maybe in Johannesburg, or you might end up here in Chicago, or in Tokyo. These companies are all over the world. They're seeing everything in front of them, the entirety of the global demand for their products. These guys from Archer Daniels Midland. They were sitting there just talking to my students, just talking about, yeah, we had this big order for I think it was corn syrup in China. So we just rerouted a couple of ships that were headed for Africa. You know, those people can go to hell because the Chinese were paying more. Now, what the hell? You're talking about you're seeing the entire world. These people are seeing it every day. And these are just hoe handles from Decatur that are just sitting there looking at the world. They got screens all around them. This is their thing. And it's certainly not like someone who's running some coffee kiosk in a sad little parking lot in Bloomington, Illinois. That person sees just the local traffic, doesn't see the billions of cups of coffee sold every day, just sees the local traffic, has price discipline because people could stop at another coffee kiosk or pull up to the Gloria Jean's drive-thru or the Starbucks drive-thru. They can't do that. They just see their tiny little sad place in the world. But these companies over here, they see all of this. Just the entire thing. And they see way far ahead. But like I said, this has its problems with it. Now, with one of these companies that's a monopoly, there is no curve of their own that's separate from the market. They are the market. The demand they face is the market demand. The supply curve, over here, this supply curve is an aggregation of thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of little marginal cost curves all meshed together to create a supply curve. Over here with a monopoly, there's just one supply curve. It's that company's own marginal cost curve above shutdown. That's all there is there. That's it. It is the one graph. And something really strange happens here with a monopoly, because what I show you in the pure economics, principles of microeconomics, it doesn't work here, because this company doesn't respond to supply and demand dynamics. There's a curve that happens when a company faces the demand curve itself. The company responds not to the demand curve, but to a curve underneath it called the marginal revenue curve. I'll show you that in the next lecture. This company actually responds to the marginal revenue curve too, but it's the same as the demand curve. When a demand curve is flat, the marginal revenue curve sits right on it. But when a demand curve tips downward, the marginal revenue curve breaks off and drops underneath it. You'll see that kind of phenomenon several times later as this course goes along, where a curve hides another curve until the first curve begins to break down or up, and then another curve that drives decision-making comes off it and shows itself. But that comes in another lecture. Now, this monopoly, there is some prohibitive and enduring barrier to entry. Now, a conservative economist would say the only way that can actually happen is if the government is protecting this company, providing it with some kind of a trademark, patent, copyright, so that no other company could come in by law. There are a couple of other ways that these barriers to entry could persist. One is through just pure, plain old violence. I can assure you that there are companies that keep their monopoly position through physical violence. Cartels do it. Drug cartels do it. Very famous stories about how companies in the past have kept their monopoly position by simply wiping out the competition. I mean, Al Capone, that was his thing. You either join me or I burn your place to the ground and shoot you and kill you. I read a story just a few days ago up in Chicago. There's a pub that was run for many years by a lady. Her husband had refused to do rum running for Al Capone, so he just burned down the place, killed the guy. So when his widow rebuilt it, she made her deal with Al Capone. Violence is a quite acceptable, historically very common way to maintain monopoly status in an industry. There was a, I don't know if I had mentioned this before, in the late medieval period and through the Renaissance, and even into the 1700s, there were several very powerful monopolies or family companies running the basically the civilized world. The most powerful, the most least well known of them was trade. Did I tell you what the big one was that they were trading in? This company was. It had acquired the facilities and resources, the coastal ports, and everything else for this product. And anyone who got in their way, who said, no, we're not going to sell ours to you, they just simply had private armies, these company armies that had used to work for the king that were running around. They just have them, the privateers would come in and blast away and kill everyone. And this family's operations would take over. I didn't tell you what this was. Do you know what it was? Do you have a guess? Take a stab. Salt. It was salt. That's right. I mean, it was so important. And you think its importance was outsized. To some extent, salt was important for preservation, curing of meats and all of that. But it went well beyond that, to the point where salt was like a ludicrously obsessive good of people of the time, for its taste, for its flavor, for its preservation properties, and also for its many believed, especially in Christianity, that salt was important in keeping warding away witches, salting the ropes, salting the land, salting the doorways was huge in some places to protect yourself from witches. Say that again. Effectively, salt was a commodity currency. You will learn about those kinds of currencies in macroeconomics. But I'll tell you right now, salt was much more important than coins for most people, because the reality is, in the old days, I mean, normal common people having money is actually quite modern. Back before the 1900s, especially, people in possession, normal people in possession of money, like dollar bills, coins, that was not almost unheard of in most places in the world. So they were engaged more in commodities kind of stuff. But anyway, there you go. There's another example of that, maintaining monopoly through violence. And also, of course, protection of the crown, because if you had, it was a lot easier for the king or queen of a country to maintain a good tax revenue base if you didn't have a whole lot of people making huge amounts of money. The fewer people making huge amounts of money, the more focused your tax revenue base could be, more reliable it was. Are any of you familiar here in Illinois with what's called the old slave mansion or the old slave house? You never heard of it? Oh, it's a really dark part of this state's history. Now, Illinois was actually technically a free state. We didn't have slaves here. However, there were a couple of exceptions in the law where slaves from the South could be leased for a one-year period and brought up here to work in various industries. Now, in southern Illinois, back in the early 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s, there was a pocket of salt that was discovered, and there was a fellow down in southern Illinois who commanded the salt mines. That was miserable, awful, horrible work, backbreaking. And he couldn't find many free people who to do it. So he took advantage of this exception in the Illinois law, which allowed him to lease slaves for 1 year period, black people from the South. Now, the reason that law was passed allowing for that exception was because people like this guy were such a huge source of tax revenue for the state. At one point, this fellow, I can't remember his name. Maybe it was. He actually provided something like it was a large percentage of the total tax revenue of the state of Illinois. So, of course, they made laws that were protecting this fellow and his tax base, and the tax base they got from him. His story got really, really awful because it turned out that not only was he leasing slaves, which was technically legal in Illinois, he was also collecting slaves, too. He would have night riders go out and capture slaves that were running north on the Underground Railroad. He was actually, in some cases, kidnapping free black families from Illinois and then selling them into slavery in the South. He would, his conditions in this giant mansion on the third floor were horrendous. There was even a rape room where he had a very intelligent slave named Uncle Bob impregnate the female blacks that he caught because they could command a higher price in the markets in the South. Here in Illinois, that was happening. That's an example of how you can get this dynamic interaction. They left him alone for years while he pulled this crap here in the state. And that's an example of that dynamic interaction of a state protecting a monopolized interest and the monopolized interest simply getting bigger and bigger. The story comes to some good ends because finally at one point he was beating a woman in his field, a black woman in his field, and another slave went over and chopped his leg off, and that made him decide that he had had enough of the slave trade. He was indicted in one case where he had kidnapped a free black family and sold them to a Texas plantation. He was not convicted of that. But ultimately, in the end, much better minds were found in Virginia and Ohio, and his operation fell apart. And now you can still go down there and see this mansion, which is reported to be really haunted. It will, people have actually, I don't think, I might be wrong, but people have tried to spend the entire night in the third floor where the slaves were shackled before they were taken out. And I don't think anyone ever has made it through the entire night in that attic there. But anyway, that's a great story. Sometime if you're interested in ghost hunting, let me know. We'll go down there and get the crap scared out of us. Okay, enough of that one. Let's go to this interesting animal right here, oligopoly. Oligopolies are a few firms, and I put few in scare quotes, because it could be two, that would be a duopoly. It could be 4, 6, 8. The interesting thing is that the last one that I'll show you, when I say many firms, but it's not a perfect competition, you could have more firms in an oligopolistic industry than in one of these other industries, but it's still an oligopoly because there's something about oligopolies that's special. The oligopolies, they don't collude. That's a cartel. Oligopolies have a fascinating behavior, which we call strategic. Anytime you see the word strategic, if I ask a question about it, you know that I'm talking about an oligopoly. Because they don't think like normal companies. Not really even like monopolies in some cases. But they certainly don't think like perfect competitors or the next one, which is called monopolistic competition. Oligopolies behave strategically. They see their competitors on this, think of it like a giant long-term chessboard. Well, I'm not interested in what my competitor is going to be doing tomorrow. Where would my competitor be in 10 years, 50 years, 100 years? They think like that. A few years back, one of the considered the personification of evil was the executive of Exxon Mobil, a hugely overweight man, sort of looked like Jabba the Hutt from Star Wars. Had a giant jowl that hung down to his man boobs. And he sort of was a personification of evil. There was a picture of him at the annual shareholders meeting the year that their profits at ExxonMobil skyrocketed because of the high gasoline prices. He was just sitting there, you know, just everything that you would hate in a pig like that of a man. But make no mistake, he was not a stupid man. He was an extraordinarily subtle, intelligent man, as these oligopoly leaders are. He said at this one meeting of executives, politicians come and go. They haul us before their committees and talk about our robber baron profits and how we are exploiting global crises and we are engineering hostilities so that we can increase our profits, blah. And they talk about how they've got to get us under control before all the oil runs out. And he said, they don't know shit. I don't know if he used that word, but he came close. He said, we don't see the short term. These politicians, they live for their next election, for their next campaign check they take from us on the side while they bitch at us in public. But at the and all these liberals, peak oil, and we're going to run out of oil someday, and we're attacking countries for their oil. And they don't know anything. These companies don't think like that. They know we're going to run out of oil. Of course they do. They know that it will get more and more expensive to extract the oil that remains. We will ravage environmentally sensitive areas. You care so deeply about global warming. Well, gee, turn off your car. Oh, you won't? Well, you don't care about it enough to stop it, do you? That's the reality of it. These companies don't think short term. Yes, there will be an end to oil. We'll be there to give you your next fix on the next energy resource when it comes time for you to have it. And we'll make sure you're docile when you get it. You will say, thank you, sir, may I have some more. That's how oligopolies work. You think you've seen the latest generation of Intel chips? They're already four generations out doing R&D on things that will blow you away in 30, 40, 50 years. You think that we're at the end of our explorations here on the land? We're going to go down into the sea, and in your lifetimes, we're going to be mining asteroids. We're going to be tearing up the moon. We're going to be blowing away big chunks of asteroids, hauling them here for what they've got. All that is going to happen. They know it. How do they know it? Because you know what the best way to predict the future is? You create it. You're not creating the future. They are. They're strategic. Across the chessboard of their competitors over 50, 100 years, down into the sea, up into the sky, into where it's dark and there's no air, they'll be there. They're planning that now in your entertainment, your next joy toy that will keep you anesthetized so that they can do what they do while you play your video games and you're living your virtual reality. They're going to be the ones who take care of you. And all they'll ask is that you shut your pie hole and let them do what they do best, plan strategically. For now, 50 years out, in 50 years, for another 50, 100 years, they will live past empires. And they will certainly live past the American empire. That's how they operate, you see. So the word is strategic. They are price setters. They plan long, long term. They don't sweat the small stuff. There's going to be a war in Iran. They'll be there, and they will take care of us when it's over. We'll scream bloody murder when the Strait of Hormuz is mined and gasoline goes to $6, $7 a gallon, and then there will be gasoline after that because we can't stop the global industries from running because that would stop the profits, and that's the important thing. So don't worry, the future is assured for you. The last one of these four types of industries is monopolistic competition. Monopolistic competition. There are many firms, and I put that in quotes, scare quotes too, many, because you see, it could be that there are fewer than there are in an oligopoly, but usually there are a lot. One characteristic is fierce competition. These are oftentimes very large corporations, and they compete profoundly against each other. Most likely, if you get a job in a big company, you will be in a monopolistically competitive industry where there is fierce competition among the big companies in the industry. In the short run, they are like monopolies. They have a product differentiated. They are in the business of making people believe, consumers believe, that their product is different. And that requires that the product have some kind of a hook on it. Something that you can use to convince consumers that it's better, that it's different. You see, because in perfect competition, one farmer's corn is just like another farmer's corn. There's no difference. You can't find a difference. But in product differentiation, you have found a difference that you can exploit in the consumer's minds. That's why you can convince consumers that there is no substitute. In perfect competition, every product is a substitute for every manufacturer's product is a perfect substitute for every other manufacturer's product. In monopolistic competition, you get the consumers to believe that there is something different, and then you have created a miniature monopoly in your product. But you can't keep that forever. Eventually, the barbarians will overrun the gates, because the way you are creating that belief is through marketing. Now, marketing is not just advertising. Advertising is an important part, but marketing has to do with the product's placement, the price, the essentially the packaging. All of those things go into it. Marketing, you spend money to get people to believe that your product is different, then you can charge a higher price. You will keep doing that as long as the last dollar you spend is less than the extra money you bring in from the higher price. But make no mistake about it, it is all about perception. It is not about the reality of the product. Because the reality of the product is that it pretty much functions like any other brand or any other company's version of it. So we have to get people to believe that it is different. We do that through a number of mechanisms that marketers use. In this age, we are in the age of relationship marketing, where we create some personal connection between you and the product. We get your email address. We lock you in with us so that you don't go other places. We will try to say iPhone, MySpace, all of these things that personalize a relationship between you and the company and therefore hook you onto that company's products, creating brand loyalty through the relationship. But there are many, many other ways that this happens. One of the most important is through fear. Fear of disease, fear of ostracization, fear of loneliness, fear of death. These are the ways that we play to you. And I've done this before with you, but think about like products like Oil of Olay. If you don't use it, you're going to get old and wrinkled, and men won't love you, and that's the only thing that matters to a woman is that she's loved by a man and produces his babies. I mean, you know that as well. If you want to die in your apartment alone and have your poodle eat you, really? Budweiser beer. You get a beer, a big horse, and a big-breasted woman. Maybe two. That's right. Dodge Ram truck. Ram, we know you don't want to be gay, do you? Ram means you know what. Honk, honk. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. Beep, beep. You got to wear the clothes that show that you are with it, hip. Because you know what happens if you don't? You get a swirly in the high school bathroom. Even 10 years afterwards, they'll drag you to the high school and give you a swirly because you're different from the other people. What are you, emo or something? Look at what we do to you. You're going to get diabetes. Oh, that's okay. We'll take care of it. We've got a whole lifestyle. We'll give you the products, and then all you have to do is buy the peripherals for it. But you don't want to have diabetes without us being there with you. Be afraid of being alone. Because you know what's after cancer? Death. You better be afraid of cancer because it will kill you unless you buy our products. You got snot coming out your nose. You're miserable. Your head goes, Kator, Kator, Kator. Well, we'll give you Claritin, and you'll float through fields in slow motion. You're depressed. You're sad. You're lonely. We've got a medicine for it. We'll take care of you. We'll give you what you need so that you're no longer an unhappy, miserable, sad, blue person, because you don't want to be that. You want to be happy like everyone else, holding a drink, laughing at a bar, getting laid all the time. I mean, how can you even get it up? Really? How embarrassing if that gets on Facebook. We'll make you happy again. You don't believe us? Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. That's all. Thank you.